Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Hey y'all, if you like Sex with Simmery, then you should totally check out Burlesque Toy Shop. Explore the fine line between pleasure and play and power and submission with Burlesque Toy Shop's A Little Kink collection. Our sex and mischief bed bondage restraints are the perfect foray into the world of dominance and submission. Turn your bed into a bondage playground with this accessibly priced kit for only $29.99. No bedpost required. Watch your lover surrender, bound by four soft but secure Velcro cuffs attached to adjustable straps. An additional connecting strip ensures that the bed bondage restraints will fit any size bed. At Burlesque Toy Shop, we encourage you to test your boundaries safely and live out your fantasies fully. Burlesque Toy Shop provides an expertly curated collection of pleasure toys and burlesque-inspired lingerie for the discerning lady and gentleman. With 100% body-safe products, elegantly designed toys, and glycerin and paraben-free lubes, Burlesque is the toy shop you wish you had next door, but instead, it's online. Use the code TIMAREE, T-I-M-A-R-E-E, for 20% off your total purchase. So again, use the code TIMAREE, T-I-M-A-R-E-E, when you visit burlesquetoyshop.com. And Burlesque Toy Shop is social, so follow on Twitter at Burlesque Toys for sexy news, hot tips, giveaways, and even better discounts. Help them out for helping us out. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and I am fangirling out again. I do this a lot. I love it. Okay. I'm really excited about today's guest, Al Vernacchio. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm super excited. So my first experience with you was when I was but a wee master's student, and I came into one of your classes for a observation of your teaching.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was like, what? I had no idea that sexuality education could look like that. And especially like the age group that you were teaching. And I was just really excited and so enthusiastic. And I'm not the only one that thinks that. Everyone thinks you're awesome. So I'm really glad you're here.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be here too. It's great to be able to speak to your audience. I speak to high school kids most of my life. So this is great to talk to adults. Yeah. About cool adult things.
And now you can say naughty words.
Ooh.
And drop F-bombs whenever we feel like it. So, Al, you are a sexuality educator. You're an author. You're a speaker. The big claim to fame that most people would probably know you from is the TED Talk that you gave.
That's right.
What was that all about?
So I gave a TED Talk because I invented sort of a new way for us to think about and talk about sex. So often, because I teach high school, I hear kids talking about sex using the baseball language and the baseball model. And that
the
is, the idea of the bases and that sex is a progression that sort of moves in increasing levels of activity until you get to intercourse and that's a home run. And also it seems that although kids sort of stop using baseball language around middle school, the concept of sex is like baseball persists all the way through high schools and even into adulthood. And it's a really lousy model. It's sexist and it's heterosexist and it's goal-directed. It's just a really unhealthy model for thinking about sex in a positive and authentic way. So I was always thinking, there's got to be a better way to talk about this. And then one day I hit on it and I realized that we should think about sex like pizza.
Meow.
Yeah, because instead of baseball, which, you know, you play baseball because it's baseball season and there's a game scheduled. It's not really your choice, but you have pizza because you're hungry. So it starts with an internal sense and desire. And baseball is competitive and eating pizza is not. And baseball's about winning and losing, and pizza's about feeling satisfied. And so it just seemed like such a better model that fit the value frame that I want to use in my classes to talk with kids about sexual activity And I, you know, I just sort of began doing it in my classes, and when I would go to colleges, I would talk about it. And it got me the attention of the New York Times, which did a piece on me in November of 2011, and that led to the opportunity to do a TED Talk, which was amazingly cool. So I got to go to TED 2012 out in Long Beach, California, and speak on the big TED stage. It was a really amazing highlight. And then recently, just in November of this past year, I did a second TED Talk at a TEDx event in San Diego, California. And it was an event that was held at a local high school. So the audience were 400 high school kids, which are my people. And it was really fun. And I did a whole new talk about the idea of sexual footprints and thinking about all the decisions that we make and the actions we take regarding our sexual selves as creating sort of a path, and thinking about where's that path going, where do we want it to go, how do we take steps in directions that are going to lead us to places that make the world a more open, loving, fun, pleasure-based place and less of a closed and tight and oppressive place. And it was very well received, so it's been a lot of fun.
The footprints idea is fairly new to me. It's reminding me a little bit of, this is going to be a little bit of a divergence, but Dan Savage's idea about, you know, the camping metaphor.
Yeah.
Is it anything like
it has echoes. There are echoes of Dan's model and my footprint model, but mine's more about helping kids to think deliberately about what they want to do, why they want to do it, and also realize that whatever activity or action we take today has implications for us down the road. So, you know, when I talk to kids and say, you know, if you could ever imagine yourself as old as I am, which they can't, you know, do you imagine that you want to be on your third divorce? You know, and nobody says that. I say, okay, do you imagine that you want to live like alone with a lot of cats? And like one or two kids always raise their hand. And
sounds pretty cool.
That's pretty cool, yeah. But no, most people want to be in a relationship that's fun and sexy and pleasurable and loving and that has a real sense of stability to it. And so if that's what we want for kids, we have to help them think about, how do you get there? You know. And while there's nothing wrong with a really good hookup and they can be really fun, if that's all you know how to do, it doesn't actually create a path that makes it easy for you to move into different kinds of relationships. So helping kids think about practicing different kinds of relationships and gathering the skills that are going to lead them to what they ultimately want is sort of what the new model is about. And, you know, it's really just about trying to think more consciously. I think so often today, because we're such a society that's so neurotic about sex, you know, thinking about sex is not really valued. It's like, you don't really think about it. You just do it. And then you sort of...
And certainly not talking about it.
No, not talking about it at all.
Talking about it will kill the magic.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So letting kids know that not only is it okay to think about it, but that it's actually really healthy to think about it. And that what's actually worse is to just move into these situations without any kind of forethought or plan or even idea of what you want. And it's, you know, some people say, well, that's going to really take the spontaneity out of it, or it's really going to make it seem artificial. And I just don't buy that. I mean, I think that when we walk out of our house to go to a party and we know that sex is on the table, we can really think about making it the best we want it to be. And if we don't want it on the table, we can think about that and make decisions that lead us that way. So rather than taking away spontaneity, I think all it does is make things more intentional, which can make them more intense and more fun. And I think that isn't that what I want for the young people that I work with, is for them to be able to create lives for themselves that they can be proud of and that they like, and that they have access to pleasure, and that they love their bodies, and that they can have the kind of relationships they want. I don't think a lot of other people, a lot of other adults talk to kids that way. And I think that's a real problem. I think we can do better in the way we talk to kids.
So many things are like registering with me that you're just talking about. I mean, the intentionality requires us to even deliberate on what we actually want, and not only not assuming that everyone wants the same thing, but actually having evaluated whether we want the things
right.
that we have been, for lack of a better word, like programmed, conditioned to sure. expect that we want these specific things at these specific intervals by a specific age, and ever actually contemplating, is that the thing that would make me happy?
Right. Right. And that we get to ask for what we want, you know, that we have a real sense of agency in that. I think so often teenagers are sent out into the world when it comes to sex, thinking that there are all these external benchmarks that they have to achieve. And to help kids realize that actually the agency belongs to you. And when you get to think about it and own it, it's you can feel so much more confident about yourself, about your body, about your pleasure. There's this silly little thing I do. I call it the underwear test, because kids often will come to me on a Monday morning and say, you know, I went to a party over the weekend and I really was just going to hang out with my friends. I wasn't really planning anything. And all of a sudden I was hooking up with somebody. Like, it just came out of nowhere. And I call that the myth of spontaneous sex, and I don't really believe in it. And so I say to kids, well, can I ask you a question? And they say, sure. And I say, did you think about what underwear you put on before you went to the party?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, yeah. I say, well, you know, doesn't that mean something? Doesn't that mean that you at least thought there was a possibility that somebody might see your underwear? And they think, oh, yeah. Like, well, okay, then you can actually own that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, yes, I had intention that it was at least on the table. I didn't know if it was going to happen or not, but I was open to it. And that allows you to be more intentional and prepared and thoughtful about it. And I think that's, you know, I think we often don't give young people enough credit that they can make really healthy decisions for themselves and that they do know what they want. Nobody ever asks them.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. So you'd mentioned talking about pleasure mm-hmm. with these students, and the idea of talking to young people, underage people especially, yeah. about sexuality causes paroxysms
yes.
in the average adult. Like, how do you even talk to these small people in general mm-hmm. about anything, much less sexuality, much less this crazy notion that sex is something other than the thing I'm telling you not to do.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing, is that, you know, starting with the fundamental value that our sexuality is a force for good in the universe and is not this destructive, damaging, dangerous thing that's going to kill us. I mean, that's where you have to start with, because a lot of times people have this really fundamentally negative and scared view about sexuality. And at that point, pleasure becomes this trap that sort of lures you into this bad place where bad things are going to happen. But if you start from a different assumption that our sexuality is, you know, the best thing about being human and is this force that allows us to be authentic and connected and intimate with people, then pleasure becomes this really positive aspect. And it's also, you know, I think people get nuts when they think about talking about sexual pleasure with kids, but we talk about all kinds of pleasure with kids all the time. Kids know what pleasure is. They know what they like and don't like. This is just another aspect of that same conversation. And to suggest that if we don't talk about pleasure with kids, they won't think about pleasure is ridiculous, because they are so keyed into pleasure and adolescents are so egocentric. It's all about them. And so they're interested in what feels good for them and what they can achieve from an interaction. And we can really take that natural place that they are and help shape that in a positive direction. But yeah, people freak out about it. But I think that, I mean, again, if you're thinking about the long-term goal here, I think a sexuality educator who says that their goal is to produce people who never have sex is a really lousy sexuality educator, mm-hmm. you know, or a sexuality educator that produces students who are afraid of sex or who have never thought about pleasure or who don't know and like their bodies is a pretty lousy sexuality educator. So what I think I have a responsibility as a sexuality educator to say to kids, look, these bodies can do amazing things and they can produce all kinds of pleasure. And also to talk with kids, and I think this is really key, about different kinds of pleasure. And what I mean by that is I do this activity with kids where I give them a handout that I made that has a bunch of different behaviors down the left-hand side of the page. You know, everything from kissing to going to the movies to oral sex. And then I say, let's think about three different kinds of pleasure. Let's think about romantic pleasure, intimate pleasure, and sexual pleasure. And there, it's a bit of an artificial division, but it works with the kids. So think about romantic pleasure as sort of highlighting the hearts and flowers, Hollywood romance, kind of Valentine's Day, Disney love stuff. Think about intimate pleasure as really connecting with someone on an authentic and deep level, getting to know them, wanting to know them, wanting to share yourself with them in an open and honest way. And think about sexual pleasure as sort of really that tingly body stuff that feels so great. Our nerves are firing, our hearts racing, the waves of intensity are flowing over us. All of these are really good. All of these can be achieved. And sometimes we're looking for one or the other. And so I think sometimes people get crazy about pleasure because they're thinking that all we're doing is telling kids to like focus on their genitals and what's going to happen with them. But pleasure is this huge topic. And helping kids understand that sometimes really what I'm looking for is just to hold somebody and feel really close to them. And sometimes I'm looking for an orgasm. And I might want those two things together, but I might want them separately. Mm-hmm. Those are conversations that I think if we just had more honestly with kids, we would help people develop such healthier sexuality than I think we, you know, likely had when we were growing up. Nobody told me about different kinds of pleasure.
And there's a very strong gendered component to this that I keep thinking of. And going back to the baseball analogy with the way that young boys, it's not even necessarily focused on, was that a positive, enjoyable right. experience for you? It was like, did you win? Did you get all the points? And right. then for girls, there's this, you know, gatekeeper mentality. So it's not even about whether you had a good time or not. It's about whether or not you let it happen and whether or not you consented to it. And then we end up with this, you know, a huge period in young girls' lives where they're sexually active, but the point is not at all to have even a good time or to have experienced something that they felt good about yeah. while it was happening. It was about whether or not you did it at the right pace. You know, you'd been together long enough that right. nobody's going to hold it against you. So,
yeah. And it's one of the things that I think we have to always talk with young people about in terms of the gender differences and sexual pleasure and sexual activity is, I mean, the way I term it is we need to decrease penis arrogance and increase vulva awareness and pride. Like every boy, you know, and too many girls have been taught that penises are like these mighty, like lightsabers that do magic and spew forth the cure for cancer.
Well, the whole
and stuff
idea,
like that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, the whole idea of virginity is that a yeah. penis is so powerful that it fundamentally changes a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, we were just talking about this in my ninth grade class and, you know, thinking about the idea of virginity. So why is virginity so important for women and not so much for men? Well, it goes back to a time when women were considered property. Mm-hmm. And so when you were getting a woman, you were, if she were as a virgin, you were like getting something that was more valuable. And kids often don't know the origins of a lot of this stuff. And when you start to unravel it for them, they get these really weird looks on their faces. Like some of them are like, no, that can't be true. And some of them are like, oh my God, why didn't anybody tell me this before? You know? And so what does virginity mean? And why is it a value? And if girls are supposed to be virgins and boys aren't, then who are boys having sex with? So that it's just the levels of ridiculousness.
I think it's I think what it, of course, is, you know, as property, it makes females into cars, you know, that they're more valuable having never been driven.
Right.
And men into active agents. They are the human beings in this scenario. Exactly. And so you want to be an experienced driver so that you perform well and you don't crash into things. But, like, there's nothing about the value of the car in that situation is purely, like, what it showed up with. And it can do nothing but depreciate from there.
Right. And if that's a great analogy because, you know, basically the car exists to serve your whims. And you know, I often say to kids, if you're not really, are you having sex with a person or are you having sex with a glorified like masturbation tool? Because so often I think kids move into sexual situations, not recognizing or thinking about their partner as a full human being person. I mean, sometimes that's some of the messages they get. Sometimes from some porn, that's sometimes what they get from, they get it from the baseball model because the woman is the field that the game is played on. And if nobody's challenging these notions, if no one's giving kids a different way to see it, if we're not reframing it for them, then they're just going to walk along the same paths that many of us walked along when we were uninformed and uneducated. And, you know, don't we already have a pretty screwed up society when it comes to sexuality? And if we really want to change that, it has to start with the way we talk to kids.
And I think this reframing of it to talk about it as an intimacy thing, an experience that you have with another person and not just a masturbatory behavior where another person is present. I think that also could be the shared ground where someone of a more, perhaps the term would be conservative slant towards sexuality, could find common ground because it is theoretically the religious model of sexuality is about we want to delay sex because we want it to be in this very specific context.
Right.
And we want it to have this specific type of meaning. But isn't the whole point that that relationship then, that intimacy is experienced through sexual behavior? So if we talk about, okay, so great, you waited till you're married. Now what? Now, how do you express love in a physical way? Let's say you waited until you're married or not. How does that play out? How do you actually physically show love?
Right. There's nothing about the act of marriage that confers upon people the knowledge of how to be intimate or how to be sexual or how to be romantic. So if it's another one of those external benchmarks that people use that really is – I mean, it's not meaningless, but it's only as good as the awareness we bring to it. And I think you're right that if we can help kids be more intentional about it, and you know, intentional might mean I'm just in it for an orgasm or I'm just in it for pleasure. But if you know that, and if you can communicate that to somebody else, and if they're okay with that, then you know, that's a very different scenario than moving into something and not being able to say to somebody, look, I'm not really looking for any strings. I'm just looking for some fun. Is that okay with you? Is that what you're into as well? So, we can determine what kind of sexual situations we want to be in, but we can only determine that if we've thought about it. Mm-hmm. And if we also think about how do we make sure the other person that we're involved with is on the same page that we are. I mean, my rule with kids is always, if you can't look somebody in the eye and talk about what you want to do with them, you shouldn't do it with them.
Yeah.
That's a really high standard, isn't it?
I mean, that's a little crazy.
I know. And when I say that to parents, they get really worried. And I think they're worried, A, because they don't necessarily do that, and B, because they imagine that their kids might do that. And I think that's an amazingly good thing. And it's more than just like, you want to do it? Yeah, let's do it. But even that is a lot more than most people do.
Yeah, you know? The actual deliberation, like the degree of conversation that goes into planning dinners.
Yes.
In contrast, you know, like, where are we going to go? And, like, we're going to have to wait this long if we go to this place. But, like, mm-hmm. can you imagine putting into that much planning into the sex that happens yeah. after dinner? So we've used the term hookup a couple times, and it's a very obviously controversial thing about whether or not hookup culture exists, mm-hmm. whether that term is just new, and whether or not, you know, casual sex ever existed before, like those sort of yeah. things.
I think it did.
Yeah. You're down in the trenches.
I am.
So what do young people think about it?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I should say that the school where I work is a fairly small independent school. So the population of kids I work with is pretty selective. So I can't speak for all teenagers, obviously. But what I do know, I know a couple things. One is that hookup means a million different things, mm-hmm. depending upon which subset of kids or adults you're talking to.
It seems intentionally vague.
Yes, absolutely. And again, that's a problem. So if you want to hook up with somebody and your definition of hookup is oral sex and their definition of hookup is a little snuggle, you're going to have problems mm-hmm. unless you clarify that. But the other thing that I think is, I don't know if it's different, but one of the things that I find really interesting with young people today is the notion of what in the Stone Age we call dating doesn't really exist anymore. That kids or exists in a different way than it did. When I was in high school, which was in the, you know, the late 70s and early 80s, the expectation was that as a teenager, you would have several different relationships, sort of serial relationships with different people, and you sort of practiced relationships. And the expectation was that, you know, some of them might be sexual, some of them might not be, but that when you got into a relationship with somebody as a high school student, it was pretty clear that it was really not going to be a long-term thing. It was sort of like, for now, we'll see how it goes. If it lasts for a few weeks or months, that's great. If it doesn't, okay. And there was permission for that. What happens today is the sort of area from the area that's not hooking up, but not like in a Facebook recognized official relationship, is really gray mm-hmm. and hazy. My students, this is great. My students actually call it a thing. Like, oh, they have a thing.
Mm. I have some students who call it a situationship.
Yeah, there you go. Mm. Yeah. They're just talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So it's interesting that, you know, they're creating their own language for this. And one of the things that I find interesting is how my sort of old man judgmental voice says imprecise the language is, but it's language that actually works for them. It's they're defining something. So they need help in figuring out how do you move from just sort of playing around, which is fine if that's where you want to be, but to something that's not as serious as being in a relationship, but that has some boundaries is the wrong word, but it has some sense of it's not quite so amorphous.
Structure?
Structure. Right. You know, because it's not really friends with benefits. That doesn't, they say, no, that's not a thing. That's different.
Like feeling out whether or not you want to get some sort of commitment.
Figuring out if you really want to take this any further and sort of being in a place where, you know, you have some level of connection, but it's pretty informal or loose. And I think we've really lost something when kids don't have a clear sense of or aren't being given the option of some kind of middle stage between hooking up and being in a relationship. And they're really confused by it.
I think, like, looking at this, like, from a super meta perspective, mm-hmm. like, I'm just pulling back, like, hundreds of years. Like, I think we're just figuring all this out, doing that sort of teeter-totter thing, because it didn't even exist a few hundred years ago. This whole concept is just that you picked someone because you found them attractive, and you wanted to hang out with them, and if hanging out with them was good enough, then you hung out with them more, and then you married that person. Right. Like, how foreign would that be to someone from, like, the 16th century?
Oh, yeah.
It would make no damn sense.
Not at all.
So that's the person your dad picked, right?
Right. And they came with this many goats, and that was cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're like, figuring it out. Like, we're less formal about it, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think it actually is a good sign that we're getting more and more based on what individuals want and is useful and is going to work with their actual lives.
Mm-hmm.
We're figuring it out.
And we have to give kids the space to figure out what it means for their generation and in their own, what makes most sense to them. I mean, you know, one of the things I think is so important with young people is giving them the space to create the definition for things. So, you know, I think the word thing is weird, but that's because I have a whole different set of terminology in my head and baggage and experience. But it's important for me to say, okay, so tell me what that means. A thing, and not to deride it just because it's a term that kids today made up, but to really say, okay, this is how you're understanding something important about the way people connect. So teach me about it. Tell me about it.
What terminology do you wish was still being used?
That's a great question. And you know, I'm not sure I really want dating, because that has such baggage to it. And I don't even know that I know the language. I just wish there were more of a sense that practicing relationships, which means more than just being sexual with people, was an okay, expected, natural part of the process. Because I think what we have is a generation of kids who are, in some ways, more than we were, really well-versed in the sexual aspects of relationships. You know, they have a lot of access to watch people have sex on the internet, and they have way more information about sexual activity than we had, and more access to it. What they still don't have a lot of is a way to practice the stuff that goes with the sex. So the conversation and mm-hmm. the hanging out with people and the situations that you create that might lead you into a sexual situation that aren't just like getting drunk together. So I think one of the things that I call it the porn model, but one of the things I think that the porn model has done to us in the way we think about sex is it's disconnected sex from the rest of our life experience. Mm-hmm. Like when I talk to kids about porn, one of the questions I always ask is, what do you imagine the people in that scene are doing 20 minutes after the camera stops? And they really have no idea. Like, are they grocery shopping? Are they, you know, looking at their phone? Are they picking up their kid from daycare? Or do they just like live in that bed or pool deck or warehouse or whatever?
Yeah. And it seems like, and of course, like a lot of porn is also, the situation is ultimately that we are going to act now on this power differential that we've been waiting to act on, which makes all sex then seem like a thing that you were just waiting to cave on, that, you know, is desirable because you shouldn't do it.
Right.
Not because, like, they're attractive and you find them interesting and mm-hmm. touching bodies is fun.
Right. And is the inevitable outcome of any interaction.
Mm.
That everything just leads to sex. And so to, you know, to have this experience where you can be with somebody and really enjoy being with them and feel close to them and feel intimate and feel turned on by them and with them, but not necessarily, if you don't want to, move it into a sexual place, or you don't have to move it into an intercourse place or an oral sex place or whatever the expectation is. I think that's the thing that we're not great at helping kids think about today.
So you are, this is going to be sort of related to what we've already been talking about. We've been talking about like sex and pleasure, but also sex ed as a form of social justice.
Yes.
So we've brought up gender a little bit in this. And you talked about why the baseball analogy is heterosexist. But what is some more on that?
Yeah, that's seeing sex ed as a form of social justice education, or teaching sexuality education through the lens of social justice, is a really important part of the way I frame what I do. So social justice is about creating a world that is more equal, that is more open, that is more accepting of people's authenticity, whatever, however that manifests itself. It's also a system, or it's also an idea that, let me try it this way. There's an amazing image that is on the web somewhere, and it's the difference between equality and justice. And so equality is, you give everybody the same thing, but we don't actually start out in the same place. So if you give everybody the same thing, the final result of that is still that some people have more than others. Justice is the idea that you give everybody what they need so that we can all achieve the same level or result. And some people are going to say that sounds like socialism, and that's really not what I'm thinking about. But so what does justice say? Justice says, in terms of sex, that we have a dynamic where power differentials are really skewed, and people don't have, or at least many of the situations people find themselves in, don't have equal power. So there's, you know, power from male privilege, there's power from heterosexism, there's power from just having more knowledge about sex and that kind of stuff. So how do we create a sexual interaction where we can even out the power? And that might mean some people who walk into it having less power get more. You know, so women actually don't have to just play gatekeeper. They get to decide that the couple together, whoever they are, gets to decide what they want together. This goes back to the pizza thing, because when you're going to have pizza with somebody, one of the first things you do is you talk about it, and you talk about what you want. And even if, like, you know, you have pizza with the same person for a really long time, you still say things like, are we going to have the usual, or are we going to do something else? All that is a way to look at a situation and say, where are the inequities, and how can we shape it so that we can minimize those inequities? I'm not sure that I believe that we actually can achieve complete equality in every aspect, in every situation. So I use the word equity a lot in my classes, which is, let's try to minimize the differentials in power, in access to pleasure, in ability to make choices, in the freedom to feel good about what we do, all those kind of things. So for me, social justice is about getting an outcome that creates less differential in power, that creates more equity in choice, that creates situations where people feel like they can be authentically themselves and valued for that. It sounds kind of heady and a little theoretical. But
so what does that look like in real life? Like, what would be an example? Yeah.
So in real life, for example, it would be something like this expectation that is out there with a lot, but not all, of teenagers, that that guys get blowjobs and girls give blowjobs. And that I see that as a hugely inequitable situation, right? Most guys are getting sexual pleasure from that. Most girls will tell me that they don't really enjoy giving blowjobs. Some do, but a lot of them don't. They feel a lot of pressure. They feel like it's something they are supposed to do. So you walk into this weird situation where even just, you know, you think about just the place where bodies are often when somebody's giving and somebody's receiving oral sex, especially with a blowjob, there's this weird, like, one person kind of towering over the other person. Mm-hmm. And so what I think would be more equitable is that people talk about, you know, if I have access to an orgasm, you get access to an orgasm. I don't know many people, men or women, who orgasm just from giving oral sex to somebody. That if I'm expecting you to do something to me that's going to make me feel good, that I have you have the right to expect the same thing from me in some way. And it's not like it's not a tit for tat. It's not like for every blowjob there has to be some other kind of reciprocal sexual activity. But if the basic pattern of a sexual relationship is somebody's consistently having less access to pleasure, less control, less ability to say my turn or this is really what I want, you know, I think that's unhealthy. And I think we can do better. But I think kids don't, that's not what they see. They don't often see people feeling empowered to ask for what they want, to know that their pleasure matters, to just have somebody really talk about how amazing their body is, you know?
This goes back again to that transactional idea, that idea that sexuality is a thing that you get, that you win. Right. And like in baseball, you steal bases.
Yeah.
That's a perfectly legitimate way to score, to mm-hmm. get ahead, to be doing the right thing. And then I think that gets ingrained in young people, that idea to see how much you can get with how little. Like, so a young teenage boy, for instance, is going to get the message that if you're going down on your girlfriend all the time and not getting ahead, like, you are a loser.
Oh, you're whipped. Yeah.
Even though, like, you're totally having a ton of sex.
Right.
Like, and if you're enjoying it, then everybody's probably winning.
Right.
But that's still losing according to that transactional model where you're, like, trying to get one over on somebody and see what you can get away with.
Exactly. And, you know, this whole notion that guys can actually really be instrumental in helping, when their partners are women, helping their female partners feel good about their bodies and know about them. I mean, you know,
rather than just saying stop calling yourself fat, actually doing something to cultivate an idea that they like being in their own bodies.
Exactly. Like, you know, helping them feel as good and powerful about their bodies as the guys do. Guys often get lots of messages that their bodies are great and powerful, and that, you know, every guy knows what his penis looks like and can pick it out of a lineup and feels, you know, generally feels good about it. But, you know, so many of the women, young women in my classes have, you know, never seen their vulvas, couldn't tell you what it looks like, and have never had somebody say to them, wow, that is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that amazing? You are so amazing. And this body is not just something that I want to rub up against because it makes me feel good, but I really want to be with you because you have this body that I find amazing and interesting and lovely, and that I want to you know, explore with you.
And it's weird how many of those messages about vulvas being bad and about vaginas being unattractive are coming from purportedly heterosexual people.
Yes.
And it's fascinating because it's like, what do you like then?
Yeah.
And then it seems to be that we get socialized, rather than to be attracted to human bodies, we are attracted to lack of humanness.
Yes.
And we really fetishize flawlessness.
Yep.
And being, I guess, closer to machinery, like not having visible pores, not having hair, not having lines or scars or things like that. Those would be terrible.
Or natural scent.
It's like, are you really sure you're attracted to people?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even going to question your heterosexual masculinity. I'm going to question are you attracted to people?
Yeah.
Because you might have been conditioned to say all these things, but if you're not actually into it, you don't have to do it.
Right.
You know, it's optional.
Yeah. Wow, that would really... That's a great question to ask kids. I'm gonna use that.
Well, because I think about asexuality mm-hmm. as like this, you know, field we know so very little about.
Yes.
But the people that are really vocal about it, you know, how representative are they of the average asexual? And how many people have gone through their lives actually being oriented towards nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And they do all the things that they're supposed to do, and right. you got married and you dated and you had the kids and that sort of thing. But what did you actually desire?
Yeah.
And I'm just curious how many people, again, the intentionality really, really mm-hmm. ever thought about it. And we talk about it in this very limited, you're either straight or you're something else, you know, lumping
right.
in
right.
all of the not straight things, because they're all the same, because they're all just not straight.
Right. They're all just not straight.
Yeah.
That's it.
How do you talk to kids about sexual orientation?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because I believe that we should be teaching human sexuality in an integrated way, right? So one of my problems with the idea of teaching about sexual orientation is that when you look at so many human sexuality textbooks, you know, the sexual orientation chapter, first of all, is only about non-straight people. And it's a separate section. Mm. So like there's like yeah. all the regular sex that regular straight people have. And then there's this odd chapter over here about these other people who do it kind of differently. And that, again, strikes me as fundamentally unequal and weird. So when I'm talking about sexual orientation, no matter what the topic is that we're talking about, I have to be mindful to make sure that my language and that my examples and that the conversations we're having can be inclusive no matter what the gender or genders of the people involved are. So for example, a really simple way. One of the things I do is I really like to use the word sweetheart to talk about a potential romantic or sexual partner, because it's not gendered and it's actually not age specific, and it's just a nice generic word. But it also it conveys something, that there's actually something you are really drawn to about this person.
A fondness.
Yeah, right. You know, it's not, because partner sounds so like
serious,
clinical, and yeah. yes, like business, like you're signing contracts together instead of just having fun. But also when it comes to thinking about sexual orientation, you know, we have to ask questions like, not just like what makes, you know, gay people gay and lesbian, but like what makes straight people straight?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do straight people actually ever come out? And what does that look like? And I mean, if coming out is simply acknowledging to yourself and then to the wider world what your sexual and romantic attractions are, then of course straight people come out all the time. It's just not recognized and it's not made a thing the way that it's made for those of us who aren't straight. I also think that because I'm gay and because I can be out in my job, the way I talk about sexual orientation, I don't know if it's different, but you know, I can't look at the world except through the eyes that I have, which are the eyes of a gay man. So, I see sexual orientation everywhere. and that's actually helpful, because I can say to my students, look, this is not just like a unit that we're doing in class, that our romantic and sexual attractions influence everything we do, and that being a human being is, again, having the intentionality and the choice and the opportunity to say, what am I attracted to? You know, to not just go with the assumption, but to actually be able to, in whatever way makes sense, explore that question. You know, it's just not true that everybody is fundamentally straight or fundamentally not straight. You know, we're fluid. That's why I love the genderbread person, Sam Killerman's little model, because it talks about everything as a continuum, as a range. And, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about sexual orientation as a deliberate like unit in a sexuality education class, we, I don't want to say we do a disservice, but I think there's a better way to do that. You know, it doesn't need to be its own chapter. It needs to be something that carries through everything we do.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise we're not being fair.
Yeah. I mean, I've, you know, many times when that question comes up, like what causes sexual orientation? Like, that's the question that's asked. The question that's heard is, why are some people gay?
Exactly.
Yeah. Which, you know, again, sort of goes back to your sex ed is social justice, which mm-hmm. is, you know, your sexual orientation does not just affect your sexual behavior.
No.
It affects your experience in the world. And a human sexuality class might be the only time that sexual orientation is discussed.
Yeah.
Despite the fact it should be mentioned in history just as much if not, you know, English. And I mean, I'm not sure if it comes up in like calculus, but you know, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? It could.
I didn't take a lot of calculus.
I didn't either.
You know, I took probably pre-cal and was like, no.
Yeah, me too. Not the place where I wanted to hang out.
However, you obviously did well in English because you are writing a book that's coming out. What's the story there?
Okay, so I'm ready. My book is called For Goodness Sex, and the subtitle is Changing the Way We Talk to Teens About Sexuality, Health, and Values. And it's coming out in September, September 9th, and it's being published by HarperCollins. And it's really a book geared towards parents or any adult who wants to get better at honestly and authentically talking with young people about human sexuality. So it sort of follows the arc of the sexuality and society class that I teach at my school, which is a class for 12th graders. It meets for a full school year every single day. So it's pretty unique in that regard. And so each chapter starts with a story from my class, and then we talk about some topic and how to be more relaxed and purposeful and comfortable talking about that with kids. And then every chapter is going to end with a it's called a question box. I have a question box in my classroom, which is an old shoebox with a hole in the top, and kids put questions in they want me to answer. And so every chapter is going to end with several questions from the question box. So it's modeling how you can answer a question mm-hmm. when kids ask it. And I'm really excited about it. I've never written a book before. It was a incredible journey. And one of my friends summed it up perfectly. She is also an author. And she said, it's hell to write a book, but it's heaven to have written a book.
Mm.
And I'm just almost at the point where I can say that I'm sort of finishing up the final edits for the book now. And it's going to be really cool to hold this thing in my hand that I wrote and be able to share it with people. And I'm really excited about it.
You lit up like a light bulb. It was so cute. And I'm excited too, because I feel like this is the exact sort of resource that is going to do so much more good than, you know, all the classrooms mm-hmm. where you only get to meet with so many people. This is going to reach so many more. And I mean, you've got the visibility that, you know, parents will be able to, oh, this guy's legit.
Right.
You know, I know who he is, so I can trust that this isn't going to be nonsense. So this could do some serious good.
I hope so. Yeah, it's, you know, I'm actually an introvert, which surprises a lot of people. So this is like a lot of exposure for somebody who is usually content to just hang slightly further back. But it's very exciting, and I have no idea, you know, what's going to happen when it comes out. I hope it's a great resource. I hope people buy it. I hope it's really helpful. But it will be out there. It'll be out there in a way that it hasn't been out there before. And, that's exciting to me that maybe, you know, cause I don't want to be stingy about my ideas or the way I teach or the way that I talk to kids. I really believe in it, and I really want other people to, if they believe in it, to feel comfortable doing it. And so this is another means to that. So
I really hope people, you know,
use it as a reference because I feel like it's the exact information that parents are wanting.
Right.
And there are not a whole lot of sources. I mean, there are, but they usually are coming from either a specific agenda or they're coming from a place where people fear that they have an agenda.
Right.
Like Planned Parenthood puts out great information, but because it's Planned Parenthood, you're going to get a whole segment of people who don't want to hear it.
Right.
And, you know, this is not going to be coming from a specific, you know, religious background or something like that. You don't have to adhere to that in order to get this information.
And it's coming from somebody who is actually a trained sexuality educator,
who
which is another thing that we don't get, who does this work every day.
Yeah.
Because so many of the books are written from the perspective of a psychologist or, you know, somebody who's a college professor. But one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was that I talk to kids every day, and I've done it for, you know, over 20 years. And I really think I have my finger on the pulse in a lot of ways. And and also, I mean, I'm somebody who's really comfortable talking about sex. And I want to be able to model that in a way and just be able to say to parents and adults, really, you can relax. This is, I often say to parents, you know, talking about sex is no different than talking about anything else, no matter how much you want it to be.
Mm.
Like, parents really get this idea that talking about sex is this whole different animal, and it doesn't have to be. And so that's one of the messages in the book that I really hope gets out there, just that take a deep breath, start with authenticity. It's okay if it's awkward. Mm. I really want to reclaim awkward as a really okay place to be in life. Because this goes back to your point about the artificiality and the mechanical. You know, if we're machines, we function perfectly all the time. But my God, sex is awkward. And talking about sex can be awkward. And that's okay.
And noisy and messy.
Yeah. And if we can't acknowledge that and laugh at it and just realize that that's exactly what being human is, and that that's all we are. You know, we're human beings, and we get to be the best human beings we can be.
And I think it's also useful for parents to acknowledge that it's okay to ask for help on these things.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so much expectation that, like, well, if you've made it to adulthood and you are a parent, you therefore must know all the stuff that a person needs to know. And this is exactly where we have sexuality education as a class that you can go take, because, you know, like, you wouldn't have that same pressure on yourself to be able to help with the pre-calc homework.
Right.
You know, like, you made it to adulthood, you have the kids, but that doesn't mean that you are an expert in everything that they might need to know.
Right.
So, you know, exactly again, why it would be a good idea to turn to someone like you for the information, because you have it.
And you can also, you know, you don't have the, you may not have the technical expertise, but you certainly have the experience of being a human being and having been an adolescent. And, you know, most of what I find, what kids want to know from their parents are things like, how did you know you were in love?
Yeah.
And how did you manage your first broken heart? And, you know, what did you do when you were my age and you were like turned on all the time? And, those are the things I would love parents to just talk more about with their kids. They, you know, we can all search together for the technical information, but the real, like, how do you be a person who has genitals and feelings and who's interested in connecting with other people? I think, you know, most people can call on their own experiences. And I think parents get really nervous because they think, oh, I didn't do it right. But that's exactly the story you want to tell, because you survived it and you came through it and you learned something from it. And boy, would that be a great story to share with your teenage kid.
Yeah.
So I, you know, while yes, I want them, I want to be able to give them information they don't have. I also want to give them confidence and encouragement that the best thing you can be is just a human being and not be afraid to own the successes and failures that come with that. 'Cause that's what we want our kids to be, is just good human beings.
Speaking of successes and also having been around in this field for a long time, you are getting a Founders Award.
I am, yes. I'm very, very excited.
Brag about it.
Okay. So the AIDS Fund, which is an organization that runs Gay Bingo and the AIDS Walk and exists to raise money to fund other AIDS service organizations. Every year they give out an award called the Founders Award, and it's to a person or a group of people who have sort of made a unique contribution to HIV/AIDS education. And I'm really honored that I'm the recipient this year. And
boom,
at the Black Tie Gay Bingo in April, I'm going to receive that award. And it's, I mean, I'm humbled by it, and it's really exciting. And as I reflect on it, what I love about it is, you know, it's really an acknowledgement of doing little things that add up to something meaningful and good. You know, I mean, I'm not a full-time HIV/AIDS educator. I used to be a long time ago, but I bring the AIDS Memorial quilt to my school, and we commemorate World AIDS Day every year. And when it comes time for our school to do service in the community, I take kids to ActionAIDS and to the AIDS Fund so that they can see those agencies and how they work and the good that they do. And so being able to be involved in the community in that way is really, you know, special and lovely. Before I was a teacher, I worked at ActionAIDS. I was the volunteer coordinator and the trainer for 4 years. And so I was deeply immersed on a daily basis in the community of people living with HIV/AIDS and the community of people serving that population. And it was in, you know, the old days before the protease inhibitors, and it was a sad and a scary time. And I met so many amazing people, both volunteers and clients, who, you know, stay in my heart, and I think about them a lot. And it's my responsibility as a person who has had those interactions to tell those stories and to make sure young people know. I mean, it's kind of amazing to think about the fact that this generation of kids is the first one to grow up in a world that has always known about HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. You know, we grew up in a time where it wasn't there and then it was, but these kids are growing up that it's just a reality of life. And in some ways that's great. And in some ways that it can become background noise. Mm-hmm. And it's still such an important issue, and we still need to help kids be aware because it's part of social justice, because it's part of being a good human being, because it's part of being a sexually healthy person. So I'm just really pleased to get this award, but I'm just also really pleased to be able to do the work every day in little ways, because I think that's what makes a difference.
Awesome. So, very, very excited about that. And I'm really excited for your book coming out. Thanks. And so people should know more about you. And how can they do that?
Okay. There's a lot of ways they can do that. I'm on Twitter at AlvSexEd, A-L-V-SexEd. I'm on Facebook. Al Vernacchio, Sexuality Educator, is my professional page. I'm on Gmail at alvernacchio@gmail.org. And you can look up my TED Talk on the TED website. And if you actually Google me, there's a lot of my stuff there. I've done a lot of, I've done some Skype interviews, and I've done some other presentations that are online. So if you just Google Al Vernacchio, you'll find lots of ways to connect with me. And as soon as the book comes out, there'll be even more. So yeah, I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email, tweet me, and come to my Facebook page.
Yay! That's adorable. I'm excited. I'm going to make you be a regular tweeter. We're going to make this happen.
I'll try. Okay. I'm up for it.
Everybody, we're challenging Al. You're going to have to tweet at him, and he's going to have to retweet and reply and do all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
Oh, it's going to get exciting. All right. So I'm super grateful that you were able to come today. This has been, as always, just like personally moving and inspiring in addition to being informative. So
I'm thankful for the opportunity to talk with you and to just be here. So thank you for the work you do. You're amazing.
Oh, shucks.
You rock.
Oh, that's all hug. It's great.
Yay.
And so thank you, Al Vernacchio, for coming in, and everybody go check him out. And thank you, everyone, for listening, and have a great day.
Hey, y'all. If you like Sex with Timmery, then you should totally check out Burlesque Toy Shop. Explore the fine line between pleasure and play and power and submission with Burlesque Toy Shop's A Little Kink collection. Our sex and mischief bed bondage restraints are the perfect foray into the world of dominance and submission. Turn your bed into a bondage playground with this accessibly priced kit for only $29.99. No bedpost required. Watch your lover surrender, bound by four soft but secure Velcro cuffs attached to adjustable straps. An additional connecting strip ensures that the bed bondage restraints will fit any size bed. At Burlesque Toy Shop, we encourage you to test your boundaries safely and live out your fantasies fully. Burlesque Toy Shop provides an expertly curated collection of pleasure toys and burlesque-inspired lingerie for the discerning lady and gentleman. With 100% body-safe products, elegantly designed toys, and glycerin and paraben-free lubes, Burlesque is the toy shop you wish you had next door, but instead, it's online. Use the code TIMAREE, T-I-M-A-R-E-E, for 20% off your total purchase. So again, use the code TIMAREE, T-I-M-A-R-E-E, when you visit burlesquetoyshop.com. And Burlesque Toy Shop is social. So follow on Twitter at Burlesque Toys for sexy news, hot tips, giveaways, and even better discounts. Help them out for helping us out. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timmery. Sex with Timmery, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimmery.com, Sex with Timmery on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timmery_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.
Hello, podcast fans. Adam Carolla here. I'm leading the fight against patent trolls who are threatening this medium. It's not about me. It's about the podcast you're listening to right now. If I go down, this show could be next. Visit fundanything.com/patent troll for more information on how you can keep podcasting alive. Thank you, and mahalo.